Mow that lawn for your mother tomorrow, said Will from the courtyard. A boy down the road does it once every 2 weeks, said Tess. Okay. I know that you're only here because of Liam, she said. What? You heard me. She'd said this before, last night in bed, and again when they'd gone for a walk today. She was repeating herself, acting like an irrational, crazy bitch, as if she wanted to make him regret his decision. Why did she keep bringing it up? She was here for the same reason. She knew that if it wasn't for Liam, she'd be in bed with Connor right now. She wouldn't have bothered to try and fix their marriage. She would have let herself fall into something fresh and new and delicious. I am here because of Liam, said Will. And I'm here because of you. You and Liam are my family. You mean everything to me. If we meant everything to you, then you wouldn't have fallen in love with Felicity in the first place, said Tess. It was so easy being the victim. The accusing words rolled with delightful, irresistible ease off the tongue. The words wouldn't roll so easily if she told him what she'd been doing with Connor while he and Felicity had been heroically resisting temptation. She presumed it would hurt him, and she wanted to hurt him. The information was like a secret weapon hidden in her pocket, which she held in the palm of her hand, caressing its contours, considering its power. Don't tell him about Connor, her mother had said urgently in her ear, just like Felicity, pulling her aside as his cab drew up at the house, and Liam ran out to greet him. It will only upset him. It's pointless. Honesty is overrated. Take it from me. Take it from her. Was her mother speaking from personal experience? One day she would ask her. Right now, she didn't particularly want to know or even care. I didn't really fall in love with Felicity, said Will. Yes, you did, said Tess, although the words falling in love suddenly seemed juvenile and ridiculous, as if she and Will were far too old to be using such terms. When you were young, you talked about falling in love with such amusing gravity, as if it were an actual recordable event. When, what was it really? Chemicals, hormones, a trick of the mind. She could have fallen in love with Connor. Easily. Falling in love was easy. Anyone could fall. It was holding on that was tricky. She could tear up her marriage right now if she chose. Tear up Liam's life with a few simple words. Guess what, Will? I fell in love with somebody else too. So everything is just fine and dandy. Off you go. All it would take was words, and they could both be on their way. What she couldn't forgive was the revolting purity of what had gone on between Will and Felicity. Unconsummated love was so powerful. Tess had left Melbourne so that they could have their affair, damn it, and they'd never got around to it. Instead, she was the one left lugging around a sleazy secret. I don't think I can do this, she said quietly. What? Will looked up from where he was squatting down, carefully pushing eggs into the latticework at the back of one of her mother's chairs. Nothing, she said. I don't think I can forgive you. She walked over to the side fence and placed a row of eggs at careful intervals all the way along the middle paling, hidden beneath the ivy. Felicity said you wanted another baby, she said. Yeah, well, you knew that, said Will. He sounded exhausted. Was it just because she got so pretty, Felicity? Was that it? Huh? What? Tess almost laughed at his panicky expression. Poor Will. Even on a normal day, he preferred his conversations to follow a linear structure. And now he couldn't complain like he normally would and say, "Make sense, woman." "There wasn't really anything wrong with our marriage, was there?" she said. "We didn't fight. We were in the middle of watching season 5 of Dexter. How could you break up with me when we were in the middle of season 5? Will smiled warily and clutched his bag of eggs. Suddenly she couldn't stop talking. It was like she was drunk. "And wasn't our sex life okay? I thought it was okay. I thought it was pretty good." She remembered Connor's fingertips running so slowly and softly all the way down her back and shivered violently. Will's forehead was furrowing as if someone had taken hold of his balls and was squeezing, just gently at first, but then gradually harder and harder. Soon she would cause him to topple to the ground. "We didn't fight? Or we did fight, but weren't they just normal run-of-the-mill fights? What did we fight about? The dishwasher? The way I put the fry pan in so it hits the thingamabob? You think we come to Sydney too often? But that's just run-of-the-mill stuff, isn't it? Weren't we happy? I was happy. I thought we were both happy. You must have thought I was such an idiot." She lifted her arms and legs up and down like a puppet. "Here comes dopey Tess, dopily going about her day. Oh, tra-la-la, I'm so happily married. Yes, I am." "Tess, don't do that." Will's eyes were shiny. She stopped and noticed there was a salty taste in her mouth now, along with the chocolate. She wiped her hands impatiently across her wet face. She hadn't even been aware that she was crying. Will took a step towards her, as if to comfort her, and she held up both her palms to stop him from coming any closer. "And now Felicity is gone. I haven't been apart from her for more than 2 weeks since, my God, since we were born. That's weird, isn't it? No wonder you thought you could have both of us. We were like Siamese twins." That's why she was so furious with him for thinking they could all three live together. Because it wasn't entirely preposterous. Not for them. She understood why they thought it was possible, and that made it all the more infuriating. Because how could that be? "We should finish hiding these stupid eggs," she said. "Wait. Can we sit for a moment?" He gestured at the table where she'd sat eating hot cross buns and texting Connor in the sunlight yesterday, a million years ago. Tess sat down and put the bag of eggs on the table and folded her arms, tucking her hands into her armpits. "Are you too cold?" asked Will anxiously. "It's not exactly balmy," snapped Tess. She was all dry-eyed detachment now. "But it's fine. Go ahead. Say your thing." Will said, "You're right. There wasn't anything wrong with our marriage. I was happy with us. It's just that I was sort of unhappy with me." "How? Why?" Tess lifted her chin. She already felt defensive. If he was unhappy, then it had to be her fault. Her cooking, her conversation, her body. Something wasn't up to scratch. "This will sound so lame," said Will. He looked up to the sky and took a breath. "This is in no way an excuse. Don't think that for a second. But about 6 months ago, after my 40th, I started to feel so... the only word I can think of is bland or flat might be a better word." "Flat," repeated Tess. "Remember how I had all those troubles with my knee? And then My back went. I thought, Jesus, is this life now? Doctors and pills and pain and bloody heat packs? Already? It's all over? So there was that. And then one day, okay, so this is embarrassing. He chewed his lip and continued. I got my hair cut, right? And my normal guy wasn't there. And for some reason, the girl held up this mirror to show me the back of my head. I don't know why she would feel the need to do that. I swear to you, I nearly fell off my chair when I saw my bald spot. I thought it was some other bloke's head. I looked like Friar Bloody Tuck. I had no idea. Tess snorted, and Will grinned ruefully. I know, he said. I know. I just started feeling so middle-aged. You are middle-aged, said Tess. Thank you. He winced. I know. Anyway, this flat feeling, it came and went. It was no big deal. I was waiting for it to pass. Hoping it would pass. And then he stopped. And then Felicity, supplied Tess. Felicity, said Will. I always cared about Felicity. You know how we were together. That sort of banter thing we did. Almost flirting. It was never serious. But then, after she lost the weight, I started to sense this vibe from her. And I guess I was flattered. And it didn't seem to count because it was Felicity, not some random woman. It was safe. It didn't feel like I was betraying you. It felt almost like she was you. But then, somehow, it got out of hand and I found myself... He stopped himself. Falling in love with her? Said Tess. No, not really. I don't think it was really love. It was nothing. As soon as you and Liam walked out the door, I knew it was nothing. It was just a stupid crush, a... Stop. Tess held up her palm as if to put it across his mouth. She didn't want lies, even if they were white lies, or even if he didn't know they were lies. And she also felt a peculiar sense of loyalty towards Felicity. How could he say it was nothing when Felicity's feelings had been so real and powerful, and when he'd been prepared to sacrifice everything for her? Will was right. She wasn't just some random girl. She was Felicity. Why didn't you ever tell me about the flat feeling? She asked. I don't know, said Will. Because it was idiotic? Feeling depressed about my bald spot? Jesus. He shrugged. She wasn't sure if it was just the lighting, but his colour seemed high. Because I didn't want to lose your respect. Tess laid her hands down on the table and looked at them. She thought about how one of the jobs of advertising was to give the consumer rational reasons for their irrational purchases. Had Will looked back on his thing with Felicity and thought, why did I do that? And then he created this story for himself, which was loosely based on the truth? Well, anyway, I have social anxiety, she said chattily. Pardon? Will frowned as if he'd just been presented with a tricky riddle. I get very anxious, over-the-top anxious, about certain social activities. Not everything, just some things. It's not a big deal, but sometimes it is. Will pressed his fingertips to his forehead. He seemed puzzled and almost fearful. I mean, I know you don't like parties much, But, you know, I'm not that keen on standing around making small talk myself. I have heart palpitations about the school trivia night, she said. She looked him squarely in the eye. She felt naked, more naked than she'd ever been in front of him. But we don't go to the school trivia night. I know. That's why we don't go. Will lifted his palms. We don't have to go. I don't care if we don't go. Tess smiled. But I sort of care. Who knows, it might be fun. It might be boring. I don't know. That's why I'm telling you. I'd like to start being a little more open to my life. Will said, I don't get it. I know you're not an extrovert, but you go out and get new business for us. I'd find that hard. I know, I do, said Tess. It frightens me half to death. I still do it. I hate it, and I also love it. I just wish I didn't waste so much time feeling sick. But I read this article recently. There are thousands of us walking around with this neurotic little secret. People you wouldn't expect. CEOs who can do big presentations to shareholders but can't handle small talk at the Christmas party. Actors with crippling shyness. Doctors who are terrified of making eye contact. I felt like I had to hide it from everyone, and the more I hid it, the bigger it seemed. I told Felicity yesterday, and she just dismissed it. She said, get over it. It was strangely liberating, actually, hearing her say that. It was like I finally took this big hairy spider out of a box, and someone looked at it and said, that's not a spider. I don't want to dismiss it, said Will. I want to squash your spider. I want to kill the bloody thing. Tess felt the tears rise again. I don't want to dismiss your flat feeling either. Will reached across the table and held out his hand, palm up. She looked at it for a moment, considering, and then she laid her hand in his. The sudden warmth of his hand, its simultaneous familiarity and strangeness, the way it enfolded hers, reminded her of the first time they met, when they were introduced in the reception area of the company where Tess worked, and her usual anxiety about meeting new people was overwhelmed by a powerful attraction to this shortish, grinning man with the laughing gold eyes, looking straight into hers. They sat silently holding hands, not looking at each other, and Tess thought of the way Felicity's eyes flickered when she asked her if she and Will had held hands on the plane from Melbourne, and she nearly pulled her hand away. But then she remembered standing outside the bar with Connor, his thumb caressing her palm, and for some reason she thought also of Cecilia Fitzpatrick, sitting in a hospital room with poor little beautiful Polly right now, and of Liam, safe upstairs in his blue flannel pajamas, dreaming of chocolate eggs. She looked up at the clear, starry night sky and imagined Felicity on a plane, somewhere high above them, flying off into a different day, a different season, a different life, wondering how in the world it had come to this. There were so many decisions to be made. How would they manage the next part of their lives? Would they stay in Sydney? Keep Liam at St. Angela's? Impossible. She'd see Connor every day. What about the business? Would they replace Felicity? That seemed impossible too. In fact, it all seemed impossible. Insurmountable. What if Will and Felicity really were meant to be together? What if she and Connor were meant to be together? Perhaps there were no answers to questions like that. Perhaps nothing was ever meant to be. There was just life, and right now, and doing your best. Being a bit bendy. The sensor light on her mother's back porch flickered, and suddenly they were plunged into darkness. Neither of them moved. "We'll give it till Christmas," said Tess after a moment. "If you still miss her by Christmas, if you still want her by then, you should go to her." "Don't say that. I've told you. I don't..."
"Shh."
She held his hand tighter, and they sat in the moonlight, clinging to the wreckage of their marriage. Chapter 52. It was done. Cecilia and John Paul sat side by side, watching Polly's closed eyelids flutter and smooth, as if they were tracking the progress of her dreams. Cecilia held onto Polly's left hand. She could feel the tears sliding down her face and dripping off her chin, but she ignored them. She remembered sitting with John Paul at another hospital, at the dawn of another autumn day, after 2 hours of intense labor. Cecilia gave birth efficiently, a little too efficiently with their third daughter. She and John Paul were counting Polly's fingers and toes, as they'd done with Isabel and Esther, a ritual like opening and inspecting a marvelous magical gift. Now, their eyes kept returning to the space where Polly's right arm should have been. It was an anomaly, an oddness, an optical discrepancy. From now on, it wouldn't be her beauty that would cause people to stare at her in shopping centres. Cecilia let the tears slide on and on. She needed to get all her crying out of the way, because she was determined that Polly would never see her shed a tear. Cecilia was about to step into a new life, her life as an amputee's mother. Even as she cried, she could feel her muscles tensing in readiness, as if she was an athlete about to begin a marathon. Soon she would be fluent in a new language of stumps and prostheses and God knows what else. She'd move heaven and earth and bake muffins and pay fraudulent compliments to get the best results for her daughter. No one was better qualified than Cecilia for this role. But was Polly qualified? That was the question. Was any 6-year-old qualified? Did she have the strength of character to live with this sort of injury in a world that puts such value on a woman's looks? "She's still beautiful," thought Cecilia furiously, as if someone had denied it. "She's tough," she said to John Paul. "Remember that day at the pool when she wanted to prove she could swim as far as Esther?" She thought of Polly's arm slicing through sunlit chlorinated blue water. "Jesus! Swimming!" John Paul's whole body heaved, and he pressed his palm to the center of his chest, as if he was in the throes of a heart attack. "Don't drop dead on me," said Cecilia sharply. She pushed the heels of her hands deep into her eye sockets and turned them in a circular motion. She could taste so much salt from all her tears. It was like she'd been swimming in the sea. "Why did you tell Rachel?" said John Paul. "Why now?" She dropped her hands from her face and looked at him. She lowered her voice to a whisper. "Because she thought Connor Whitby killed Janie. She was trying to hit Connor." She watched John Paul's face as his mind travelled from A to B, and finally to the horrendous responsibility of C. He pressed his fist to his mouth. Fuck, he said quietly into his knuckles, and it began to rock back and forth like an autistic child. This was my fault, he mumbled into his hand. I made this happen. Oh, God, Cecilia, I should have confessed. I should have told Rachel Crowley. Stop it, hissed Cecilia. Polly might hear. He stood up and walked towards the door of the hospital room. He turned back and looked at Polly, his face ravaged with despair. He looked away, plucked helplessly at the fabric of his shirt. Then he suddenly crouched down, his head bent, his hands interlocked at the back of his neck. Cecilia watched him dispassionately. She remembered how he'd sobbed on Good Friday morning. The pain and regret he felt for what he'd done to another man's daughter was nothing compared to what he felt for his own daughter. She looked away from him and back at Polly. You could try as hard as possible to imagine someone else's tragedy. Drowning in icy waters, living in a city split by a wall, but nothing truly hurt until it happened to you. Most of all, to your child. Get up, John Paul, she said without looking at him. Her eyes stayed on Polly. She thought of Isabel and Esther, who were at home with her parents and John Paul's mother right now, along with various other relatives. John Paul and Cecilia had made it clear that they didn't want any visitors at the hospital yet, so everyone was gathered at the house. Isabel and Esther were being kept distracted for now, but the siblings always got neglected when something like this happened to a family. She would have to make sure she found a way to be a mother to all three of her daughters through this. The PNC would go, but Tupperware would go. She turned to look again at John Paul, who was still hunkered down on the floor, as if protecting himself from a bomb blast. Get up, she said again. You can't fall apart. Polly needs you. We all need you. John Paul removed his hands from his neck and looked up at her with bloodshot eyes. But I'm not going to be here for you, he said. Rachel will tell the police. Maybe, said Cecilia. Maybe she will. But I don't think so. I don't think Rachel is going to take you away from your family. There was no real evidence for this, except somehow she felt that it was true. Not right now, anyway. But I think we've paid, said Cecilia, her voice low and vicious. She gestured at Polly. Look how we've paid. Chapter 53. Rachel sat in front of the television watching the colourful, hypnotic flicker of images and faces. If someone had turned the TV off and asked her what she'd been watching, she couldn't have answered. She could pick up the phone this minute and have John Paul Fitzpatrick arrested for murder. She could do it immediately, or in an hour's time, or in the morning. She could wait until Polly was home from hospital. Or she could wait a few months. 6 months. A year. Give her a year with her father, and then take him away. She could wait until the accident was far enough in the past for it to be a memory. She could wait for the Fitzpatrick girls to grow a little older, to get their driving licenses, to not need a daddy. It was as though she'd been handed a loaded gun, along with permission to shoot Janie's murderer at any time. If Ed was still alive, the trigger would have been pulled already. The police would have been called hours ago. She thought of John Paul's hands around Janie's neck and felt that old, familiar rage blossom across her chest. My little girl. She thought of his little girl. The glittery pink helmet. Break! 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 If she told the police about John Paul's confession, would the Fitzpatricks tell them about her own confession? Would she be arrested for attempted murder? It was only luck that she hadn't killed Connor. Was her foot on the accelerator an equal sin to his hands around Janie's neck? But what happened to Polly was an accident. Everyone knew that. She rode her bike straight in front of Rachel's car. It should have been Connor. What if Connor had been dead tonight? His family receiving that phone call. The call that meant for the rest of your life you never heard a phone ring or a knock on the door without a chill of fear. Connor was alive. Polly was alive. Janie was the only one who was dead. What if he hurt someone else? She remembered his face at the hospital, ravaged with worry over his daughter's mangled body. She laughed at me, Mrs. Crowley. She laughed at you? You stupid, egotistical little bastard. That was enough to make you kill her. To take away her life, to take away all the days she could have lived, the degree she never earned, the countries she never visited, the husband she never married, the children she never had. Rachel shook so hard she felt her teeth chatter. She stood. She went to the phone and picked it up from the receiver. Her thumb hovered over the keys. A memory came to her of teaching Janie how to call the police if there was an emergency. They'd still had that old green rotary dial phone then. She'd let Janie practice by dialing the numbers, and then she'd hung up before it actually rang. Janie had wanted to act out a whole little performance. She'd made Rob lie on the kitchen floor while she yelled into the phone, "I need an ambulance! My brother isn't breathing!" "Stop breathing," she'd ordered Rob. "Rob, I can see you breathing." Rob had nearly passed out, trying to please her. Little Polly Fitzpatrick wouldn't have a right hand anymore. Was she right-handed? Probably. Most people were right-handed. Janie had been left-handed. One of the nuns had tried to make her write with her right hand, and Ed had gone up to the school and said, "Sister, with all due respect, who do you think made her left-handed?" "God did. So let's leave her that way." Rachel pressed a key. "Hello?" The phone was answered much quicker than she expected. "Lauren?" said Rachel. "Rachel, Rob's just coming out of the shower," said Lauren. "Is everything all right?" "I know it's late," said Rachel. She hadn't even looked at the time. "And I know I shouldn't impose like this, after all the time you spent with me yesterday. But I wondered if I could come over and stay the night there. Just this once. For some reason, I don't know why, but I just find myself unable to..." "Of course you can," said Lauren. And suddenly she shrieked, "Rob!" Rachel heard the deep rumble of Rob's voice in the background. She heard Lauren say, "Go and pick up your mother." Poor dear Rob. Under the thumb, Ed would have said. "No, no," said Rachel. "He's only just got out of the shower. I'll drive myself." "Absolutely not," said Lauren. "He's on his way. He wasn't doing anything. I'll make up the sofa bed. It's surprisingly comfy. Jacob will be so happy to see you tomorrow morning. I can't wait to see his face." "Thank you," said Rachel. She felt all at once warm and sleepy, as if someone had placed a blanket over her. Lauren, she said before she hung up, you don't have any more of those macarons, do you? Like the ones you bought for me on Monday night? They were divine. Absolutely divine. There was the briefest of pauses. Actually, I do. There was a quiver in Lauren's voice. We can have some with a cup of tea. Easter Sunday. Chapter 54. Tess woke to the sound of heavy rain. It was still dark. About 5 a.m., she guessed. Will lay on his side next to her, facing the wall and snoring gently. The shape and smell and feel of him were so ordinary and familiar. The events of the past week seemed inconceivable. She could have made Will sleep on her mother's couch, but then she would have had to deal with Liam's questions. He was already far too aware that things were not quite normal. At the dinner table last night, she'd noticed his eyes darting constantly back and forth between herself and Will, monitoring their conversation. His wary little face broke her heart and made her so furious with Will she could barely look at him. She shifted slightly away from Will's body so that they weren't touching. It was handy that she had her own guilty secret. It helped bring her breathing back to normal during those sudden bursts of rage. He'd wronged her. She'd wronged him right back. Had they both been suffering a form of temporary insanity? It was a defense for murder, after all. Why not for married couples? Marriage was a form of insanity. Love hovering permanently on the edge of aggravation. Connor would be asleep now, in his neat flat, smelling of garlic and laundry powder, already beginning the process of moving on and forgetting her for the second time. Was he kicking himself for falling for that no-good, cold-hearted woman yet again? Why was she making herself sound like a woman in a country and western song? To soften it, presumably. To make her behavior seem tender and melancholy. Not slutty. She had a feeling that Connor liked country music, but she might have been making it up, confusing him with another ex-boyfriend. She didn't really know him. Will couldn't stand country music. That's why the sex had been so good with Connor, because they were essentially strangers. It was his otherness. It made everything, their bodies, their personalities, their feelings, seem more sharply defined. It wasn't logical, but the better you knew someone, the more blurry they became. The accumulation of facts made them disappear. It was more interesting wondering if someone did or didn't like country music than knowing one way or the other. She and Will must have made love, what, 1,000 times? At least. She started to calculate it, but she was too tired. The rain got harder, as if someone had turned up the volume. Liam would have to do his Easter egg hunt with an umbrella and gumboots. It must have rained on Easter Sunday before in her lifetime, but all her memories were sun-dappled and blue-skied, as if this was the first sad, rainy Easter Sunday of her life. Liam wouldn't care about the rain. He'd probably love it. She and Will would look at each other and laugh, and then they'd look away again, fast, and they'd both be thinking about Felicity and how strange it was without her. Could they do this? Could they make it work on behalf of one beautiful little 6-year-old boy? She closed her eyes and rolled onto her side, facing away from Will. Maybe Mum was right, she thought hazily. It's all about our egos. She felt she was on the edge of understanding something important. They could fall in love with fresh new people, or they could have the courage and humility to tear off some essential layer of themselves and reveal to each other a whole new level of otherness, a level far beyond what sort of music they liked. It seemed to her everyone had too much self-protective pride to truly strip off down to their souls in front of their long-term partners. It was easier to pretend there was nothing more to know, to fall into an easygoing companionship. It was almost embarrassing to be truly intimate with your spouse, because how could you watch someone floss one minute and the next minute share your deepest passion or tritest of fears? It was almost easier to talk about that sort of thing before you'd shared a bathroom and a bank account and argued over the packing of the dishwasher. But now that this had happened, she and Will had no choice. Otherwise, they'd hate each other for what they were sacrificing for Liam. And maybe they'd already begun when they shared their stories last night about bald spots and school trivia nights. She felt equal parts hilarity and tenderness at the thought of Will's face dropping when the hairdresser held up the mirror to show him the back of his head. The compass her father had sent her was sitting on the bedside table. She wondered what would have happened to her parents' marriage if they'd decided to stay together for her. If they'd really tried, out of love for her, could they have done it? Probably not. But she was convinced that Liam's happiness was the most valid reason in the world for her and Will to be here, right now. She remembered how Will had said that he wanted to squash her spider. He wanted to kill it. Maybe he wasn't here entirely for Liam's sake. Maybe she wasn't either. The wind howled and the glass of her bedroom window rattled. The temperature in the room seemed to plunge and Tess felt all at once violently cold. Thank God Liam was wearing his warm pyjamas and she'd put that extra blanket on him. Otherwise, she'd have to get up in the cold and go check on him. She rolled towards Will and pressed the length of her body against his back. The warmth was an exquisite relief and she felt herself begin to slide back into sleep. But at the same time, she pressed her lips to the back of his neck. Accidentally. Reflexively. She felt Will stir and put his hand back to caress her hip. And without either of them making a decision or asking the question, they found themselves making love. Quiet, sleepy, married love. And every move felt sweet and simple and familiar. Except that they didn't usually cry. Chapter 55. Grandma! Grandma! Rachel emerged slowly from a deep, dreamless sleep. It was the first time in years that she'd slept without the lights on. Jacob's room had heavy, dark drapes across the window, like a hotel, and Rachel had fallen asleep almost instantly on the sofa bed pulled out next to his toddler bed. Lauren was right. The sofa bed was surprisingly comfy. She couldn't remember the last time she'd slept so deeply. It felt like a skill from her past that she'd assumed she'd lost forever. Like turning a cartwheel. "Hello," she said. She could just make out the shape of Jacob's little body standing next to her bed. His face was level with hers, his eyes shining in the darkness.
"You here?"
He was amazed. "I know," she said. She was amazed herself. Lauren and Rob had offered for her to stay the night so many times, and she'd always refused, instantly and adamantly, as if she had a religious objection to the idea.
"Raining," said Jacob solemnly,
and she registered the sound of heavy, settled rain. There was no clock in the room, but it felt like it was about 6 o'clock. too early to start the day. She remembered with a slight sinking of the heart that she'd said she'd go to Lauren's family's house for Easter lunch. Perhaps she'd feign illness. She'd stayed the night after all. They would have had enough of her by lunchtime. And she would have had enough of them. "Do you want to hop in with me?" she said to Jacob. Jacob chortled as if she was one crazy grandma and hauled himself up into the bed. He climbed on top of her and buried his face in her neck. His little body was warm and heavy. She pressed her lips against the silken skin of his cheek. "I wonder if..." She caught herself just in time before she said, "I wonder if the Easter Bunny has been." He would have hurled himself from the bed and run through the house searching for eggs, waking up Rob and Lauren, and Rachel would have been the annoying house guest and mother-in-law who reminded the child it was Easter. "I wonder if we should go back to sleep," she said instead, thinking it highly unlikely for both of them. "Nah," he said. Rachel felt the soft flutter of his eyelashes against her neck. "Do you know how much I'll miss you when you're in New York?" she said in his ear. It made no sense to him, of course. He ignored the question and wriggled himself into a more comfortable position. "Grandma," he said happily. "Ugh," she said as he dug his knee into her stomach. The rain got harder, and the room felt suddenly colder. She pulled the blankets tighter around their bodies and held Jacob closer and sang into his ear. "It's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring. Went to bed and bumped his head and couldn't get up in the morning." "Again?" demanded Jacob. She sang again. Little Polly Fitzpatrick was waking up this morning with a body that would never be the same because of what Rachel had done. It would seem outrageous to John Paul and Cecilia. They'd be shocked for months before they finally learned, as Rachel had, that the unthinkable happened and the world kept turning and people still talked at length about the weather and there were still traffic jams and electricity bills, celebrity scandals and political coups. At some point, when Polly was home from hospital, Rachel would ask John Paul to come to her home and describe Janie's last moments to her. She could see exactly how it would be, his strained, frightened face when she opened her door. She would make her daughter's murderer a cup of tea, and he would sit at her kitchen table and talk. She wouldn't grant him absolution, but she'd make him tea. She would never forgive him, but perhaps she would never report him or ask him to give himself up. After he left, she would sit on her couch and she would rock and keen and howl. One last time. She would never stop crying for Janie, but that would be the last time she would cry like that. Then she would make a fresh pot of tea, and she'd decide. She would make her final decision about what needed to be done, what price needed to be paid, or if, in fact, it had already been paid. "Went to bed and bumped his head and couldn't get up in the morning." Jacob was asleep. She shifted his weight off her and moved him over, so his head was sharing her pillow. On Tuesday, she would tell Trudy that she was retiring from St. Angela's. She couldn't go back to school and risk seeing little Polly Fitzpatrick or her father. It was impossible. It was time to sell the house, sell the memories, sell the pain. Her thoughts turned to Connor Whitby. Was there a moment when his eyes met hers as he ran across the road? A moment when he recognized her murderous intent and ran for his life? Or was she imagining it? He was the boy that Janie had chosen over John Paul Fitzpatrick. You chose the wrong boy, darling. She would have lived if she'd chosen John Paul. She wondered if Janie had truly loved Connor. Was Connor the son-in-law Rachel was meant to have in that fantasy parallel life she never got to live? And did Rachel therefore owe it to Janie's memory to do something nice for Connor? Have him over for dinner? She shuddered at the thought. Absolutely not. She couldn't turn off her feelings like a tap. She could still see the fury on Connor's face in that video, and the way Janie had shrunk from him. She knew, intellectually at least, that it was nothing more than an ordinary teenage boy desperate for a straight answer from a teenage girl, but that didn't mean she forgave him. She thought of the way Connor had smiled at Janie in the video, before he lost his temper. The genuinely smitten smile. She remembered, too, the photo in Janie's album, the one where Connor had been laughing so fondly over something Janie had said. Perhaps one day she'd post Connor Whitby a copy of that photo with a card. Thought you might like to have this. A subtle apology for the way she'd treated him over the years, and, oh yes, a subtle apology for trying to kill him. Let's not forget that. She grimaced in the darkness and turned her head and pressed her lips against Jacob's scalp for comfort. Tomorrow I'll go to the post office and pick up a passport application. I'll visit them in New York. Maybe I'll even do one of those damned Alaskan cruises. Marla and Mac can come with me. They don't mind the cold. Go back to sleep now, Mum, said Janie. For a moment, Rachel could see her so clearly. The middle-aged woman she would have become. So sure of herself and her place in the world. Bossy and loving. Condescending and impatient with her dear old Mum, helping her to get her first ever passport. Can't sleep, said Rachel. Yes, you can, said Janie. Rachel slept. Chapter 56. The official demolition of the Berlin Wall happened as efficiently as its construction. On the 22nd of June 1990, Checkpoint Charlie, the famous symbol of the Cold War, was dismantled in a strangely prosaic ceremony. A giant crane lifted out the famous beige metal shack in one piece, watched by foreign ministers and other dignitaries seated on rows of plastic chairs. On the same day, in another hemisphere, Cecilia Bell, recently returned from her trip to Europe with her friend Sarah Sachs, and in an extreme state of readiness for a boyfriend and a properly structured life, went to a housewarming party in a crowded two-bedroom unit in Lane Cove. "You probably know John Paul Fitzpatrick, don't you, Cecilia?" the party host shouted over the thump of the music. "Hi," said John Paul. Cecilia took his hand, met his grave eyes, and smiled as though she'd just been granted her freedom. "Mummy!" Cecilia woke with a giant gasp as if she'd been drowning. Her mouth felt dry and hollowed out. She must have been asleep with her head tipped back against the chair next to Polly's bed, her mouth gaping. John Paul had gone home to be with the girls and get them both some clean clothes. Later on this morning, if Cecilia gave the word, he would bring Isabel and Esther in for a visit. "Polly," she said frantically. She'd been dreaming of the little Spider-Man boy. Except, in the dream, he was Polly. "Try to watch your body language," the social worker had said to her last night. "Children read you much better than you think. Your tone of voice, your facial expressions, your gestures." "Yes, thank you, I know what body language is," Cecilia had thought. The social worker had had her hair pushed back with a pair of oversized sunglasses, as if she was at a beach party. Not at the hospital at 6 o'clock at night, talking to parents in the middle of their own worst nightmare. Cecilia couldn't forgive her for the flippancy of those damn sunglasses. Of course, wouldn't you know it, Good Friday was the worst time for your child to suffer a traumatic injury. A lot of the regular staff were off for the Easter break, so it would be a few days before Cecilia met all the members of Polly's rehabilitation team, including a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a psychologist, and a prosthesis specialist. It was both comforting and horrifying to know that there were procedures in place for this, with information packs and top tips, and that they would be travelling a path already trodden by so many other parents. Each time someone talked with matter-of-fact authority to Cecilia about what lay ahead, there would be a moment where she lost the thread of what they were saying because she would suddenly feel immobilized by shock. No one at the hospital was sufficiently surprised by what had happened to Polly. None of the nurses or doctors clutched Cecilia's arm and said, "My God, I can't believe it. I just can't believe it." It would be disconcerting if they did, but it was also somehow disconcerting that they didn't. That's why it was comforting to listen to the dozens of messages on her mobile phone from her family and friends, to hear her sister Bridget practically incoherent with shock, to hear the normally unflappable Mahalia's voice breaking, to hear the school principal, dear Trudy Appleby, burst into tears, apologize, and then call back and do it again. Her mother had said no fewer than 14 casseroles had already been delivered by school mums. All those casseroles she'd made over the years finally coming home to roost. "Mummy," muttered Polly again, but her eyes were shut. She seemed to be talking in her sleep. She shuddered, and her head moved from side to side agitatedly, as if in pain or fear. Cecilia's hand hovered over the call button for the nurse, but then Polly's face calmed. Cecilia breathed out. She hadn't realized she was holding her breath. This kept happening too. She had to remember to breathe. She sat back in the chair and wondered how John Paul was doing with the girls, and without warning, she was racked with a violent spasm of hatred, like nothing she'd ever felt in her life. She hated him for what he'd done to Janie Crowley all those years ago. He was responsible for Rachel Crowley's foot on the accelerator. The hatred spread throughout her body like fast-acting poison. She wanted to kick him, to punch him, to kill him. Dear God, she couldn't bear to be in the same room as him. She breathed shallowly and looked around her desperately for something to break or hit. "Now is not the time," she told herself. "This will not help Polly." He blamed himself, she reminded herself. The thought of his suffering gave her some relief. The hatred gradually eased to a manageable level. She knew that it would come again, that as Polly suffered through each new stage, Cecilia would look for someone other than herself to blame. That was the root of the hatred, the knowledge of her own responsibility, her decision to sacrifice Rachel Crowley for her family had led to this moment in this hospital room. She knew that her marriage was damaged at its very core, but she knew also that they would keep limping along together like wounded soldiers, for Polly's sake. She'd learn how to live with the waves of hatred. It would be her secret, her loathsome secret. And once the waves passed, there would still be love. It was an entirely different feeling from the uncomplicated, unstinting adoration she'd felt as a young bride, walking down the aisle to that serious, handsome man. But she knew that no matter how much she hated him for what he'd done, she would always still love him. It was still there, like a deep seam of gold in her heart. It would always be there. Think about something else. She pulled out her iPhone and began making a list. Today's Easter Sunday lunch had been cancelled, but Polly's 7th birthday party would go ahead. Could they have a pirate party in the hospital? Certainly they could. It would be the most wonderful, magical party ever. She'd make the nurses wear eye patches. Mum? Polly opened her eyes. Hello, Princess Polly, said Cecilia. This time she was ready, like an actress about to sweep onto a stage. Guess who dropped off something for you last night? She produced an Easter egg from under Polly's pillow. It was wrapped in shimmering gold, with a red velvet ribbon tied around the middle. Polly smiled.
The Easter Bunny.
Even better. Mr. Whitby.
Polly went to hold out her hand for the egg, and an expression of mild bemusement crossed her beautiful face. She frowned at her mother and waited for her to fix things. Cecilia cleared her throat, smiled, and took Polly's left hand firmly in her own. Darling, she said. So it began. Epilogue. There are so many secrets about our lives we'll never know. Rachel Crowley will never know that her husband wasn't, as he said, seeing clients in Adelaide the day that Janie was killed. He was on a tennis court, taking part in an intensive tennis workshop he hoped would teach him how to break bloody Toby Murphy's serve. Ed hadn't told Rachel beforehand because he was embarrassed by his motivations. He'd seen the way Toby looked at his wife and the way Rachel looked back. And he never told her afterwards because he was deeply ashamed and blamed himself, however illogically, for not being there for Janie. He never picked up his racket again and took his silly secret to his death. Speaking of tennis, Polly Fitzpatrick will never know that if she hadn't ridden her bike in front of Rachel Crowley's car that day, she would have received a tennis racket for her 7th birthday from her Auntie Bridget. 2 weeks later, she would have turned up for her first tennis lesson, where after 20 minutes, her coach would have gone over to his boss on the next court and said quietly, "Come and see this kid's forehand." And the swing of her racket would have changed her future as swiftly as it changed when she swung the handlebars of her bike to follow Mr. Whitby. Polly will also never know that Mr. Whitby did hear her call out to him that terrible Good Friday, but pretended not to, because he was desperate to get home and put his ludicrous fish kite back in the cupboard, along with his equally ludicrous hopes about another chance at a relationship with his goddamned ex-girlfriend, Tess O'Leary. Connor's crippling guilt over Polly's accident will help put his therapist's daughter through year 9 of private school and will only begin to ease the day he finally raises his eyes to meet those of the beautiful woman who owns the Indian restaurant where he has his post-therapy curry. Tess O'Leary will never know for sure whether her husband Will is the biological father of their second child, the result of an accidental pregnancy conceived one strange April week in Sydney. The pill only works when you take it, and she'd left the packet behind in Melbourne when she flew to Sydney. Not a word will ever be spoken of the possibility, although when Tess's adored teenage daughter mentions 1 year at Christmas lunch that she's decided to be a PE teacher, her grandmother will choke on a mouthful of turkey and her mother's cousin will spill champagne all over her handsome French husband's lap. John Paul Fitzpatrick will never know that if Janie had remembered the doctor's appointment that day in 1984, her doctor would have listened to her describe her symptoms, and after observing her unusually tall, long, skinny body, would have tentatively diagnosed her with a condition called Marfan syndrome, an incurable genetic disorder of the connective tissues, thought to have been suffered by Abraham Lincoln, involving elongated limbs, long thin fingers, and cardiovascular complications. Symptoms include fatigue, shortness of breath, a racing heartbeat, and cold hands and feet due to poor circulation, all of which Janie experienced on the day she died. It's a hereditary condition, probably also suffered by Rachel's aunt Petra, who dropped dead when she was 20. The GP, who, thanks to an overbearing mother, was a high achiever and an excellent doctor, would have got on the phone and arranged an urgent appointment at the hospital for Janie, where an ultrasound would have confirmed her concerns and saved Janie's life. John Paul will never know that it was an aortic aneurysm that killed Janie, not traumatic asphyxiation, and that if the forensic pathologist who'd done Janie's autopsy hadn't been suffering from a debilitating flu that day, he would not have been so willing to acquiesce to the Crowley family's request for a limited autopsy if possible. Another pathologist would have done the full autopsy and seen the evidence, clear as day, of an aortic dissection, the indisputable cause of Janie's death. If it had been any other girl but Janie Crowley in the park that day, she would have staggered, gasping for air, when John Paul realized what he was doing before the 7 to 14 seconds it takes for the average man to strangle the average woman, and dropped his hands, and she would have run, tears streaming, ignoring his shouted apologies. Another girl would have reported John Paul to the police, who would have charged him with assault, sending his life ricocheting in an entirely different direction. John Paul will never know that if Janie had gone to her doctor's appointment that afternoon, she would have had urgent life-saving surgery that very night. And while her heart was recovering, she would have phoned John Paul and broken his heart over the phone. She would have married Connor Whitby far too young, and divorced him 10 days after their second wedding anniversary. Less than 6 months later, Janie would have bumped into John Paul Fitzpatrick at a housewarming party in Lane Cove, just moments before Cecilia Bell walked in the door. None of us ever know all the possible courses our lives could have, and maybe should have, taken. It's probably just as well. Some secrets are meant to stay secret forever. Just ask Pandora.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Husband's Secret. This program was executive produced by Patty Perus. The Husband's Secret is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated. Copyright 2013. All rights reserved. The book The Husband's Secret is available wherever Amy Einhorn books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.